Good morning. I'm Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition.
Blah, 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 blah.
Good morning. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. And today is a busy, busy day. There's so many things going on. George W. Bush is eventually going to be heading back to Crawford, Texas, back to the tumbleweed he calls his alleged ranch. And word is Cindy Sheehan's going to be heading back that way as well. That ought to be fun, Dan Pashman.
Absolutely. How are you, Mark?
All right. How you doing, man?
Good, good. I'm feeling good. I'm very excited that Cindy Sheehan's going back to Crawford on the same day Bush is going back. He's ending the vacation from his vacation and going just back to his vacation.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris Lopresto, good morning to you.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
All right, man. How you feeling?
I'm feeling great.
All right. Now, you know, Bush took time out of his busy schedule yesterday to slam Cindy Sheehan a little bit in his own kind of offhanded, wacky little way.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about that later this morning. We're also going to talk about the fact that 3 days may not be enough for this Iraqi constitution. There's a very interesting article about why the Sunnis fear this new constitution. We're going to talk about that. The firestorm, and I'd use another word, but we can't use it on the air here. The storm around Pat Robertson.
The bleep storm.
The bleep storm around Pat Robertson is getting heavier and heavier. But you know what? I find it fascinating. Some people are not distancing themselves quite as much from Pat Robertson as they perhaps ought to be at this point. And, you know, I heard someone earlier this morning say, you know, what would have happened if Jesse Jackson or Minister Farrakhan had talked about offing somebody like this? Everybody and their grandma, there'd be a denunciathon that would last for 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
But this is Pat Robertson. I guess because he ran for president. I don't know why. He gets a little bit of slack.
Well, I'll tell you why, because he's a right-wing Christian wacko.
Well, that he is. He's a Christian wacko. And later this morning, we're going to talk about some of the consequences, some of the unintended and unseen consequences of Pat Robertson's lip. See, because, you know, there's a whole thing going on now trying to curry favor with the Venezuelans. And guess who's in the game?
Who's that?
China!
Oh.
Yeah, they need oil. And guess where they may get it? At our expense. Well, we'll get into that.
Right.
I have to give, and I must say, I have never been a particular fan of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, but I must give him, you know, his props. For the pullout from the West Bank in Gaza. The Israelis have managed to do that with a minimum of violence, with a minimum of injuries, and as far as I can tell, Dan, no loss of life.
Yeah, I mean, it really is amazing. They sent the soldiers in without any weapons. And they, not only did they do it without any loss of life, they did it early. They finished early.
Yeah, they finished early.
The way it was handled, really, I mean, you really couldn't have asked for it to be handled any better.
Yeah, and, you know, again, I am not a fan of Ariel Sharon's necessarily, but in this instance, he said he was going to do something, he stuck to it, and the Israelis deserve a great deal of credit, in my eyes, for promoting something that I think will eventually start to bring peace.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, let us please hope so. A bunch of other stuff. Later this morning as well, we're going to get into a little statement that Monsieur Pashman made yesterday about the city of brotherly love, because boy, we got some emails about that. You know, Chris Lopresto's team last night, I don't know what they did. What are they, on roids or something?
No, man, they just scored 2 touchdowns.
Yeah, right. They beat the Arizona Diamondbacks 14-1. My God. That's a behind whipping.
And Victor Zambrano pitched 8 shutout innings. So
now here's a question for you: how many Zambranos are there in Major League Baseball?
At least 2 that I can think of on the top of my head.
Who's it? Victor and Carlos.
Right, right.
No relation.
No
Carlos
relation.
Carlos is on the Cubs. My beloved Cubbies.
He's a pitcher.
Right. They're both
pitchers.
He's a good one.
Really?
The Mets got the not-so-good one.
I wonder what they think of what Pat Robertson has to say.
Yeah, right.
They're a Venezuelan guy. There are a bunch of Venezuelans playing Major League Ball.
It's true.
There's been quite an influx. But be that as it may, the Mets won. The Yankees won, too?
Yeah.
In New York, of course. We're based here in New York City. That's why every now and then we have to run this whole New York thing. You know what I'm saying?
And the Yankees are now tied for first place in the wild card.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
You know, real quick, I would like to say, you know, when they first invented the wild card, there were a lot of naysayers,
many naysayers,
purists who said it was bad for the game, this and that. I know Bob Costas was leading that charge. Man, he pisses me off. But anyway, you know, and you know, when you see now at the end of each baseball season, the amount of increased excitement in the final stretches of the season because of the wild card is a great thing for the sport. It's a great thing for fans. And anyone who said the wild card was not a good idea, eat it.
Eat it. Okay. Well, apparently people in Oregon aren't eating it. They aren't eating it as much as everybody else.
Not as much as the people in Alabama.
Oregon is the only one of 50 states where obesity rates have remained constant.
Yeah.
Every place else in America, especially in the South. Now, of course, you know, they as soon as they say it's in the South, they start stereotyping. Well, you know, there's a lot of minorities down there, and you know how fat minorities are.
Right.
And, you know, they like to eat all of that lard, and they like to do stuff in bacon fat, and they like to do Southern cooking is loaded with cholesterol, et cetera. But Oregon, and we let's say a great good morning to all our friends out in Portland.
That's right.
They got a deal here. They know what's up.
They're definitely a lot healthier, though. Although, Riley, frankly, I mean, you're getting me a little hungry talking about cooking all these things with pork fat.
Oh, God.
You know, Brandon over there and I have a soft spot for things cooked with any pork product.
Oh, my. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Didn't I see? Oh, that's right. You had turkey this morning. It wasn't ham.
No,
right?
It's turkey, right. But it is definitely mostly in the South. And, I mean, I definitely think that there is a slight racist undertone to some of the comments that are made there. Although I do think that another factor is that healthier food tends to be more expensive. And so people who are in a lower socioeconomic status, regardless of what race they are, have a higher level of obesity. Just because, you know, McDonald's, you can feed your whole family for $10, but we all know that that's not very healthy.
No, it's not, but I'm going to tell you something else. You can actually feed your family with healthy food if you know what you're doing when you walk into a supermarket. If you scan the coupons, if you scan the produce sections of a lot of these places, you will find stuff. Certainly when I go to my local produce, I find broccoli on sale. I find string beans on sale. I find these different fruits and vegetables on sale all the time.
Right.
And if you're, you know, if you're smart about how you shop for them, not to say that I'm any great chef, because I'm not. My wife is the only thing keeping me alive at this point as far as food is concerned. But I'm going to tell you, you can if you, you know what you're doing. And I've always believed that people who know, regardless of income bracket, should spread that information to people who may not know, who may think that McDonald's is the only way that you can feed your family,
right,
you know, for less than $10 for a meal. Because I don't think it's true. And I think, you know, with some careful planning, you can get around it. Now, we should say this morning, we should mark with a great deal of sadness, in fact, the passing of Brock Peters. African-American actor. He's been an actor for better than a half century. He's best remembered for his performance in To Kill a Mockingbird when he played the accused rapist in what was, at the time, a groundbreaking film.
Yes.
But Brock Peters was, he died at the age of 78 from pancreatic cancer with his family at his bedside, which is, you know, I'm sure that to some extent was a comfort to him because I think, you know, when you're fighting a battle like that, you really do want to have your family around you. But Brock Peters was just, I mean, he played Admiral Cartwright in two Star Trek feature films. He's been in I don't know how many different TV shows. He was in the Wild Thornberrys movie. I mean, he's just, his voice was a constant. A lot of Americans may not have known who he was, but they have, in fact, heard his voice. And he's going to be greatly missed. He was a groundbreaking African-American actor. Brock Peters is dead at the age of 78. So, Pashman.
Yes, sir.
Well, never mind. We'll get to that a little later on. Coming up, we're going to talk about Dan Pashman's love affair with the city of brotherly love to the point that they now have his face in the train station at 30th Street in Philadelphia saying, look, don't get off the train here.
Yeah, it's a battery target.
Yeah, well, we got an email that we're going to read about that a little bit later on. But we're also going to talk about Bush and Cindy Sheehan because it really is starting to get ugly in terms of the president trying to maintain this delusion that Cindy Sheehan is just a passing thing and that the majority of Americans, particularly a majority of those who have lost loved ones in Iraq, agree with him that the only way you can settle all this is to continue the namby, I'm not going to say namby-pamby, the ridiculous policy that he has done up until now. I can't figure out why anyone would think that what we're doing in Iraq is working. Even Chuck Hagel doesn't think that.
Right.
But George W. Bush apparently does. And we're also going to talk about this Iraqi constitution and what it's going to be like for Condoleezza Rice to get up and promote this thing when, in all likelihood, it will disenfranchise women just like her if she was living there. We'll get to that and a whole lot more coming up on this edition of Morning's Edition at 16 minutes past the hour on Air America Radio.
Mornings Edition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
Past the hour. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation, and we got some stories for you this morning. They're putting cameras in the trains here in New York City, and they're going to make the New York City subway system as annoying as every other place where people can use their cell phones, because along with all these new security changes, people will be able to use the cellies underground. They have not now been able to. But my God, that scares me. I'll tell you, it's bad enough, you know, seeing people on their cell phones driving around, you know, running into stuff. Now you're going to have people being annoying in the train, even more annoying than they normally are in the trains. Oh my God. Dan Pashman's here with us. B-Mac, hey. Brendan McDonald as well.
Hey Mark,
what's
how are you?
How you
you
doing?
Know, I was taking calls in the booth there, and one came through that I thought we would like to put through on the air. We haven't talked to him in a little bit of time here on Morning's Edition, but people who listen to us might be familiar with this.
You know, whoever with a phone system can themselves in the mouth and eat their own waste. You know, that's what I say. So leave me alone. I'm trying to get a good take.
All right, now that was obviously, for those of you who know, Brian from Everett,
yes.
our regular caller here on Morning's Edition, who left some angry voicemails at some point. That was actually a while ago.
That was a while back.
We've spoken to him plenty of times before that. But,
yeah.
But Brian, you told me you have kind of guilt about that clip.
I do. That's a drunken, spewing, cursing nonsense.
That's why we play it.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
You know what? Let me tell you something. I've been looking through my Sir Francis Bacon handy reference book here. You know what that is, Riley?
No, I only know Sir Francis Drake. Sorry.
This is the Bible.
Oh!
Listen to this. Listen to what it says about liberals in Isaiah chapter 32, verse 5.
Is that Isaiah Thomas?
It's Isaiah... Yeah, the vile person shall be no more called liberal, and then the liberal deviseth liberal things, and by liberal things shall he stand.
Okay,
you know what I'm saying? But I had a little song to play that has to go with this.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay,
let's make it short. We ain't got much time, Brian.
Okay, it's just a little. It's something to lift a curse off of me.
Okay.
Okay, I weep for I have been most vile, cursing, spewing, drunken, vile. And now I wish a pleasant style to let the little children smile. That's it.
Wow. That was like a kind of most deaf spoken word.
Yeah,
there.
Really.
Yeah, hey, but, you know,
so was that your confession, Brian?
Like, that was my liberal confession.
Yeah, I know.
Because I'm just, there's no reason, because, you know, there's certain people who will take that information and use it against you in certain ways.
Right. Okay. Well, so,
kind of
so good. We're glad we got, you know, because we didn't do the liberal confession this week with Maron not here. It's a lowered level of guilt in the room without him in here.
Yeah,
we still want to give you a penance, though, okay?
What should I do?
All right. Here's your penance for what you felt was some venomous bile. Your penance is to now never call in to that show in Seattle that you are cheating on with us.
Yeah, what is we know about
that. What the hell is that crap?
The Maynard and Clem show or something like that? It's terrible.
About the Jackanapes.
Yeah.
Well, no.
What's up with that?
No, they are really. They are more.
This sounds like a guilty conscience to me.
Yeah, you sound pretty guilty.
You know that? Yeah, I read up on them, Brian. They say that they're like the 18-year morning veterans of talk radio. It sounds like more like 80-year veterans. That show put me to sleep.
But they are the bile merchants, and I kind of latched onto them, but I got to get away from them too, don't I?
See, this is a good
purge
for you, Brian.
So this would be some closure and a new start for me, won't
right.
it?
And yeah. now, especially if you stop calling, because I know Maron was pissed when he heard those tapes of
me
talking
on
that Seattle station. So now I know that if you get rid of this, get this out of your system, it'll be much better when Maron gets back.
Maron was pissed that I gave him stuff I played on another station, or did I?
He was pissed that you're cheating on us.
Yeah, you're cheating on us, man.
But I was cheating on
them. We feel spurned. Oh, you were cheating on them with us?
I've left them, and I'm with you.
Oh, oh wow. It's great to be the paramour.
Did you go
wow.
to divorce court or something for that?
Huh?
You're really starting to scare me, Brian.
Just let me relax, man.
There you go. There you go.
All right.
Relax.
All right.
All right, man. Take care, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Wow. I got an inconsistent. Oh, never mind. We
won't
get into
that. Guy.
That.
I love that guy.
Brian's the greatest. He's out in Everett, Washington. It's where it's still the middle of the night there.
He is not, however, our greatest fan. I would say that
Penelope
in Wyoming is our best fan ever. And I would defy anyone listening who thinks that they are our great fan to try to beat Penelope.
You're going to have to send a tremendous amount of food, clothing, mixed CDs, and other cool paraphernalia.
She made us a baseball bat.
She made us a baseball bat. You're going to have to send us a whole bunch of cool stuff.
She also just
awesome. You can
go
ahead and find the address if you want. You want to compete with Penelope. Go online and find our office address and send us all the swag you want.
Yeah, please. Now, we got a few minutes left before we go to break. And I want to talk about this Pat Robertson thing because it seems like it's starting to get legs of its own.
Yes.
First of all, Donald Rumsfeld kind of tried to distance at least the Defense Department from Pat Robertson's statement. And for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, Robertson said on his 700 Club show that Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, the elected president of Venezuela, should be assassinated. He said that that would save America the cost of going to war with him, and we'd get his oil anyway. Right. Now, that is a fascinating statement for either a private citizen or someone who's run for president before or someone with close and tangible ties to the Bush administration to make. And there's some context for this in terms of what America sees, because a lot of people say, well, we've never tried to assassinate any foreign leader. We've never played a role in that sort of thing.
Right.
Well, if you think that, ladies and gentlemen, think again. And we're going to run that by you a little later on as well, because America has a long and tawdry history of assisting people who were going out and murdering heads of state, going back to the 1960s with Patrice Lumumba and going forward from there up until the Church Committee. The Church Committee began investigating some of these excesses, and in fact there was an executive order issued by Gerald Ford, then President Gerald Ford, that prohibits Americans from going out and assassinating folks, but apparently that's not a problem for Pat Robertson.
Right.
You know, it's like, hey, kill them all, let his God sort them out.
Yeah, and let's not even mention this guy's supposedly a Christian.
Yeah, supposedly. We're going to tell you a little bit about a soldier who got a slap on the wrist in the death of that Afghan detainee. Some U.S. people are, some U.S. officials are saying that terrorists may pose as vagrants. So watch who you give your money to on the streets of our cities. And we'll have that and a whole lot more coming up next on Air America Radio. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Good morning. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on a well-deserved vacation. And coming up later this morning, among our very special guests, former Labor Secretary Robert Reich joins us to talk about why that economic recovery we're hearing so much about hasn't trickled down to most average Americans. We'll speak again with Karen Meredith, Gold Star mother whose son Kenneth Ballard was killed in action in Iraq. She'll be joining us on the phone from Crawford, Texas. And Michael Wolff, contributing editor from Vanity Fair, joins us in studio to explain why the media's got to take some of the weight for the Karl Rove-Valerie Plame CIA scandal. And Dan Pashman, looks like it's going to be a hot time in Crawford with Bush coming back and Cindy Sheehan coming back.
That's right. It's all coming back today, man. And I think you're going to see a serious ramping up of the intensity on all sides over what's going on in Crawford starting this afternoon.
You know, it seems as though the pro-Bush forces have been trying to ramp up their activity ever since they heard Cindy Sheehan had left Crawford.
Right. Well, as we discussed, I mean, they're such cowards. You know, they don't have the courage to face her and confront her and deal with her, so they wait until she's gone to move in. But, of course, that makes perfect sense, Mark, because they take their cue from the president, who has also been fleeing from Cindy Sheehan. He ran away to Idaho to escape her.
Well, you know, we're talking now about a situation where Bush, I think, has really become delusional, not just about Cindy Sheehan, but about the entire Iraq war effort. And, you know, there are people now starting to ask questions like, why is this guy taking such a long vacation when the country's at war? He'll be the first one. He and his people will be the first ones to tell us that we are at war when it suits his purpose. But then he takes this long vacation. He goes bike riding. He does this. He Nobody's got a problem with him spending quality time with the first lady. Well, whatever that means, whatever floats your boat, if you know what I mean.
Right.
That's not a problem. But he's taking this long vacation, and it doesn't seem as though he's doing. Now, maybe we'll get a bold policy initiative when he comes back or something.
Yeah, but don't hold your breath, Mark.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Don't hold our breath. Cindy Sheehan has been doing the heavy work that George W. Bush has abandoned,
right,
as far as I'm concerned. This is a guy who does not seem to have any empathy whatsoever. He'll meet with the families of soldiers who've died in the war. He'll meet with them, but I don't think he empathizes with them in any way, shape, or form. Now, that's just my opinion. Maybe some of the people who actually did meet with him came to a very different conclusion. But I got to tell you that what Cindy Sheehan has begun here, George W. Bush no longer can stop.
You're right, Mark. And he is trying desperately to stop it, though, in spite of the fact that I agree he cannot. And we see that just yesterday, Bush really started to take on Cindy Sheehan a little bit more. He had some harsh words for her. But I think, you know, they really support what you just said, that he is fleeing from reality. One of the things he said yesterday, one of the real battles that's going on here, you know, he said of Cindy Sheehan, she doesn't represent the view of a lot of the families I have met with. Now, the battle that's going on here between the left and the right over Cindy Sheehan is to say, it is over whether or not Cindy Sheehan represents the majority opinion, mm-hmm, in America. Does she represent a minority or a majority? Now, I believe strongly that she represents a majority. In recent polls, prove me and us here in America to be correct in saying that, because just last week a poll showed that 61% of Americans disapprove of the way President Bush is handling Iraq. But conservatives are extremely good on various issues at making a minority sound and feel like a majority.
Yeah, they are specialists at that. And see, with Bush meeting with the relatives of dead soldiers, with Bush making the statements that he made yesterday over in Idaho, what he appears to be doing, again, at least to my eyes, is trying to marginalize Cindy Sheehan and the people who support her. Well, they're right, not the majority. They're not the way most people are reacting. There is, I guess, as far as he's concerned, a pro-Bush way of reacting to losing a loved one in a war that nobody, least of all Bush, can explain or rationalize at this point. But this is, in the end, all about politics for this guy.
Yes.
He has an agenda, and later on we're going to talk to former Labor Secretary Reich about how it's not working on the economic front all that well either. But he has an agenda in Iraq. He has been pushing the Iraqi constitution writers to get this thing done, largely because, and this is how all of this is interconnected, ladies and gentlemen, he needs some good news from somewhere.
Desperately.
He can't get it in Crawford. Cindy Sheehan has seen to that. He's gone to Idaho. He couldn't have, that was damage control. That was not good news for George W. Bush. The only place that he can get good news right now, because Congress is in recess, so his boys can't pass anything for him to sign, the only place he's going to get good news is out of Iraq. And the only way he's going to get good news out of Iraq is if this Constitution gets done, no matter what. No matter whether it disenfranchises the Sunnis, no matter whether it disenfranchises women, no matter whether it creates, in effect, a tripartite Iraqi theocracy, which it may well do.
Yes.
All of these things are coming together, and they're putting some pressure on this guy. George W. Bush doesn't like pressure. All you have to do is watch him in a press conference. Watch him when he gets pinned down on certain questions. Watch the darting of the eyes. Watch the hesitancy in you know, formulating responses. All of this, to me, says this is a guy who really does not like to be challenged. You know, there used to be this televangelist that was on TV, and he'd get on television, and he would say, you know, people, just call me with good news and call me with your contributions. I don't want to hear from anybody who's got any bad news for me whatsoever. If you don't want to donate, don't call here. Well, that's George W. Bush's attitude. Again, in my humble opinion, this is just an opinion here. I just get the sense that this is a man who lives in a world that he has created for himself. And now that things are not going right, he doesn't know how to cope with it. He's been told that plan A was going to happen and work. And now suddenly it isn't, and he's got no plan B.
You're absolutely right, Mark. I think that he is getting increasingly desperate. And a sign of that desperation is, you know, usually he has his henchmen do his dirty work for him. He's had them over the past week or two attacking Cindy Sheehan while he has tried to take the high road. But just yesterday, we saw just how desperate he's becoming when he went after her directly. And he went so far as to take a cue from many of his henchmen by smearing Cindy Sheehan with a lie. He said of her, quote, "I think those who advocate immediate withdrawal from not only Iraq but the Middle East are advocating a policy that would weaken the United States." Who the hell ever said we should withdraw from the whole Middle East? Certainly not Cindy Sheehan.
No.
Not anyone down at Camp Casey. Not any liberal. Not anyone on this network. Not anyone that I've heard has said that, you know, with regard to any of this issue. And so, but he said that, suggesting, you know, in an attempt to make Cindy Sheehan look more extreme and more out of touch than she is. In reality, she's right on the ball.
Well, yeah, she is right on the ball. And he is, in fact, and see, this is where Bush gets into a paradox here. He is pushing on the Iraqis in an effort to deflect attention away from Cindy Sheehan.
Right.
By the way. He is pushing the Iraqis to develop a constitution in which his own Secretary of State, were she to live in that country, would not be able to inherit money the same as if she had a brother. That is the fact of what he's doing. And by the way, we have yet to hear a word from Bush about Pat Robertson.
Right.
Now, sooner or later, you know, it's one thing for Rumsfeld to say something and other people to poo-poo, oh, yeah, we don't advocate that sort of. This is Bush's boy here.
Yeah.
Okay? As far as some people in Latin America are concerned, you know, Robertson's statement that Hugo Chavez should be assassinated comes very close to U.S. policy because of the close relationship between Bush and the evangelical Christian community. He is going to have, when he gets finished slandering Cindy Sheehan, he's going to have to say something about Pat Robertson. This is not going to die. It is not going to simply go away. And all of this is pounding at this guy at the end of August.
Yeah.
This is amazing because now we're looking at a ramp up into next year's congressional elections. Doesn't affect him directly, unless he's impeached, of course. But at this point, he's got to try and keep a Republican majority in Congress to continue whatever legacy he thinks he has. He's already got some Republicans in Congress, people like Chuck Hagel and others, questioning his policy in Iraq, sounding more like Cindy Sheehan than Chuck Hagel.
Right.
You know? And at a point, he is going to have to confront all this. And quite frankly, I don't think he's got the capacity to do it. Intellectually, morally, or on any other level, I do not think this president is up to what he has created by invading Iraq. And certainly, when we see what Cindy Sheehan has done, what one individual, all right, and we are constantly told you can't fight City Hall. I mean, that's an axiom that goes throughout our lives, that one person out of 300 million cannot make a difference. Well, you know what? Outside of George W. Bush, Cindy Sheehan has probably made more difference as one single human being than anybody in America in the past 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And if it keeps going like this, I believe that this anti-war movement that she has spearheaded, knowingly or unknowingly, with the help of leftist organizations or without the help of leftist organizations, it has the possibilities of seriously eroding this man's presidency, and I think he knows it. And I think he fears her. For that, I don't think we've heard the end of his speaking about Cindy Sheehan. This is soon, or it looks as though now it's becoming a slugfest between the two of them. She's going back to Crawford because of her son, and because of the sons and daughters of a lot of other people that we don't even know about who have died in Iraq.
Right.
Certainly, George W. Bush doesn't know about. He may meet with 5 or 10 people who are, by the way, very carefully screened because Bush, like I said, doesn't want to hear any bad news. But believe me when I tell you, he's going to hear more of it. He's going to hear more of it. And, you know, if Iraq descends into civil war, that will be on his watch and on his hands.
Yeah.
There's no way you can get around it. We are going to take time out of our diatribes on world issues to talk about some sports stuff. Coming up next, Lance Armstrong gets accused of doping again, and the Tampa police have decided for various and sundry reasons that now is the time to commence their 10th annual Gooden Fest, where they try and stop legendary pitcher Dwight Gooden on the streets for some infractions, and now it looks like he's a wanted man.
Yeah.
And By the way, we'll also get to Dan Pashman's little thing about a certain city that's about 90 miles south of here. Yep. Coming up next, it's 45 minutes past the hour, and this is Air America Radio.
Dateline, New York, the city we built on rock and roll. Hi, kids. This is your War on Brains correspondent, Mort Milvington, reminding you to always stay informed. And when you can't do that, try listening to Morning Sedition every morning here on Air America Radio, your Xanadu, now with Splenda.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Come on!
Let's go!
Chris LaFresco just bopping his head out through this because he is the big Mets fan up in here. Our next live broadcast will be our biggest ever. We're going to be at the New School Friday, September 9th. We'll have former Senator Bob Kerrey and The Daily Show's Stephen Colbert. That's Friday, September 9th at the New School's Tishman Auditorium on 12th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues right here in New York City from 6 to 9 a.m.
Hey, Riley, you know who's going?
Who?
Dwight Gooden.
What? You mean it's Gooden Fest again in Tampa?
Yes, absolutely.
Man, they got him on another DUI, apparently. Now, I didn't know that there was such a thing as a felony DUI. I figured a felony DUI, you had to hit somebody with your car.
Is it a repeat offender? Is that
I guess it must be. He's been out on bail after a March domestic violence arrest. He's wanted on felony charges of DUI and fleeing police. Maybe that's the part.
Right.
Whatever it is, he may end up doing some time. Tampa cops are looking for him, as they always are. He left the scene of a traffic stop after he refused to get out of his car to take a field sobriety test. They stopped his car because, and see, now, this is a black thing. He was weaving in and out of traffic in downtown Tampa. Now, maybe he was. Maybe he was driving
completely
erratically.
See, I would just think that's a Dwight Gooden thing. I'm sure he's weaving in and out of traffic plenty of times.
Let me tell you something. When you see black people getting involved in traffic stops, invariably, the cop stopped him because he was driving erratically.
Yeah.
Or he was weaving in and out of traffic. Or he was acting suspiciously behind the wheel of a car. My God. Or maybe his back left taillight was out or something. And then, you know, then the process starts. And maybe, I don't know. I mean, I've always had a soft spot in my heart for Dwight Gooden.
Oh, me too. I mean, this is one of the Mets' best pitchers ever.
He used to throw a curveball that looked like something was falling off the end of a table. The ball would come at you waist high, and then suddenly it would drop. Yeah. I mean, just drop. And guys would flail at it like there was no tomorrow. Now, speaking of flailing, Lance Armstrong, the 7-time Tour de France winner, is going to be doing some flailing of his own. You know why? Because the greatest accusations for someone to make are accusations that your opponent cannot disprove. And Lance Armstrong has now been alleged to have taken a blood doping drug called EPO in the Tour de France back in 1999. Apparently, this French magazine, L'Equipe, managed to get a hold of some urine samples, and they cross-checked some numbers, and they came up with Lance Armstrong's number, even though the urine donations were anonymous at the time they were taken.
Yeah, the testing sounds real suspect.
Yeah, I got a real problem with this. I mean, the fact is that the French have been after Lance Armstrong for years. They have been hell-bent on busting that guy. And this is not like a Barry Bonds situation where, you know, there's all these rumors about Bonds, but the guy's never taken a drug test, or maybe he started this year in the first year of testing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Lance Armstrong has taken literally dozens and dozens of drug tests, and he has never failed a one. And the French hate the fact that an American, let alone a Texan, is wiping the French Alps with their stupid heads, all right? And he's crushing them year after year in the Tour de France.
You know, it's also, I think, if Lance Armstrong is on something, he's on something that can't be tested at this point. There's no way he's on something that's going to show up in a standard pee test.
Right. No.
I think the real story is they actually keep urine samples from 1999.
That's another thing.
I would have thought it would have evaporated by now, for God's sake.
How could that be legal? That you don't know what chemical things happen to pee after that amount of time.
I mean, that's a long time.
That is a very long time. But again, it's perfect because, you know, the French have an accusation that no one can refute, least of all Lance Armstrong. All he can say is, I've never taken the drugs. And you know, given what Rafael Palmeiro said and what was later proved against him, now that people are starting to look at Lance with some skeptical eyes, and I don't know whether that is warranted or not. But Brendan B. Mac McDonald, you got an email.
I did. Well, while we're talking about sports, let's play a little clip of, we know that Kalo's a Mets fan, and you were talking to him about this yesterday, Riley.
Yeah.
And it led to another comment that shot off a storm of a response from our listeners. Let's hear that, Chris.
Why did you become a Mets fan, by the way? Just real quickly. We're almost out of time, but I got to know this.
Oh, I was just born a Mets fan.
Born a Mets fan.
You don't become a Mets fan. You were born
DNA.
A Mets fan.
Oh, it's part of the DNA?
Yes, yes.
Brooklyn Mets. Bronx? No, Yankees.
No, it has I know a lot of Bronx people that are Met fans.
Really?
It has nothing to do with that.
Those are probably people that hate Steinbrenner.
Well, the truth is the Yankees stink. they're a bunch of greedy Republican bastards.
Oh!
And the Mets represent everything that's good about New York. The Brooklyn Dodgers. The
beer. The fights in the stands.
Look, the Mets.
Pouring beer on top of unsuspecting patrons below you.
No, that's Philadelphia, buddy.
Oh,
wrong city.
Okay, innocent joke there on Dan Patrick's part, but maybe not so innocent because we actually here at the show know how you feel about Philadelphia and its fans, Dan.
Yeah.
And a listener, several listeners, but this one in a pretty descriptive email wrote in and is calling you on that. Here we go. Here's the email from Jim.
Bring it on, Jim.
Yeah.
Guys, as a lifelong, diehard, long-suffering Philly fan, I have to comment on the comments made on your show. Philly fans are the most loyal fans ever, hands down. We fill stadiums in the best and worst of times, usually the worst of times. We are sick and tired of hearing about how ruthless and unruly we are, and why do we have that reputation? Well, it's an incident that took place 37 years ago in a stadium the Eagles don't even use anymore. I refer to the booing of Santa Claus. Many other cities
snowballed.
Let me finish the letter. You can defend it. Many other cities have had much uglier incidents. Do we hear anything about the unruly Cleveland beer bottle throwing fans or the brawling Piston fans, etc.? No. Stereotyping is wrong, and we would like to shed that stereotype. Please set the record straight. Jim, diehard Eagles fan. Now, we're gonna take a break here.
Yeah.
And I would like.
I can't wait to get back.
When
to
we
this
come
guy.
Back,
I got something to say.
Yeah, we'll have to parse this Philly rowdy fan situation. If there's anybody listening from Philly, I'd like you to call in and defend your fair city or piss on it. I don't care. Whatever you'd like to do, it's fine. But the email here definitely very upset over what you said, Dan Pashman. We'll have to get your comments on
that. Right. You have been taking the task, pal. 866-303-2270 is the number. 866-303-2270. Philadelphians, even though we're not on in Philly, come on and defend your city, huh? We got some more for you coming up here on Air America Radio. It's 57 past the hour.
Let's go, let's go. We got the teamwork to make the dream work. Let's go.
Call us at 866-303-2270. Morning Edition on Air America Radio.
It's 6 minutes past the hour.
What?
6 minutes past the hour.
What?
6 minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on a well-deserved vacation. And momentarily, we're going to be going to you on the telephones. People who want to talk about the city of brotherly love. Thanks, of course, to our producer, Dan Pashman, who has ignited a firestorm of controversy I guess some might say misguided comments about the great city of Philadelphia. But before we get to that, we just want to let you who are waking up in our 7 o'clock hour know what's going on. Cindy Sheehan is going back to Crawford, Texas, back to Camp Casey to keep up the vigil, to meet with George W. Bush. George W. Bush is going back to Crawford, too, but he's going back to sleep, apparently.
Right.
I don't know exactly what he's doing. He's been he was in Idaho yesterday. I think he's still in Idaho this morning selling some wolf tickets at Cindy Sheehan because he really can't think of anything else to do. The head of Iraq's Constitutional Committee says more time may be needed. That is, by the way, more time than the 3 days they just extended themselves just the other day.
Which was an extension
of a previous deadline.
Right.
Wow, deadlines just sort of come and go over there in Iraq, don't they?
Yeah.
And Venezuelans are reacting to Pat Robertson's call for the assassination of their duly elected president. Pat Robertson Christian terrorist. But we'll get to that a little bit later on as well. Brendan McDonald, BMAC is here.
Hello.
Along with Dan Pashman.
Hi.
You know, you're in trouble, man. You're in deep doo-doo.
Yeah, I'm not scared of these Philly fans.
No.
Well, you might be surprised at some of the calls we're getting, and this is in reference to the comment Dan made yesterday about Philly fans being very rowdy. And I think this speaks on a very American level of interpersonal relationships. And this person, emailer Jim, who was listening to the show, came to the defense of his fair city, saying that they have this reputation for this incident that occurred 37 years ago, the booing of Santa Claus at an Eagles game.
And they threw snowballs at Santa Claus. Jim left that part out. They threw snowballs at Santa Claus.
Yeah, but at least it wasn't batteries, all right? Let's look on the bright side.
I'll get to that in a minute.
Okay, well, much other cities have had much uglier incidents since, he says. Do we hear anything about unruly beer bottle throwing Cleveland fans? That was just in 96, wasn't it?
That was like a year or two ago.
I heard about that.
And brawling Piston fans. Well, that was all over the news.
Yeah.
I guess what he's saying is that that those don't seem to stick. That Philly has had the that it has stuck on Philly for these kind of rowdy behaviors.
I have a response to this. All right, if Jim thinks that this 1968 incident where Philly fans booed and threw snowballs at Santa Claus is the isolated incident, then he's either drunk or stupid. I mean, I don't know what that is. Now there's a long history, a long litany of things that Philadelphia sports fans have done. They booed the two greatest Philadelphia baseball players in history, Mike Schmidt and Steve Carlton. They threw batteries at J.D. Drew of the St. Louis Cardinals because he had refused to play for the Philadelphia Phillies because he knew what he would be getting into.
Wow.
They cheered when Dallas Cowboys star Michael Irvin, who I don't love Michael Irvin, but they cheered when Michael Irvin lay paralyzed on the field. They cheered.
You know what's the funniest thing about that? I mean, nothing's really funny about it.
Tell us what's the funniest thing about
that. There's a list that Dan has in front of him talking about the 10 biggest booings that have gone on in Philadelphia.
Right.
And read what it says about Michael Irvin.
Michael Irvin was not included on this list since technically Eagles fans cheered.
When
Howard Cosell brought up the Santa Claus incident in 68, Eagles fans tossed an M80 into his announcer booth.
Strong feelings. They're passionate.
All this has led up to, for those of you who don't know, in 1997, they installed Eagles Court, a courthouse and jail in the basement of the Eagles Stadium.
Well, that was the vet, man. It was a jail anyway.
They brought the jail to the new stadium, too, Riley.
Oh, they brought it there?
And just so people who are the political people out there, you know, don't get upset that we're talking about sports, I want to put this into Air America terms, all right, of what Philadelphia sports fans are.
Okay.
You know how Christian conservatives don't believe in evolution?
Yeah.
Well, if you don't believe in evolution, or as far as I'm concerned, there is no more proof than the 75,000 or so people that go to Philadelphia Eagles games.
Wow.
They are subhuman Neanderthals. Now, if you want to see real progress, if you want to see the evolutionary chain of command, work your way up the New Jersey Turnpike to Giants Stadium, where the New York Giants play.
He's got to compare Philly fans and Giants fans.
And you will see a higher step on the evolutionary ladder where civilized people watch football.
I don't feel that I can respond to this because I have, you know, I'm not a Philly fan at all. But do we have anybody that can?
We have some people on the line, man. Let's go to the phones. And Pashman, please duck. Let's go first to Ed, who's calling us from the city of Philly. Ed, how you doing, man?
Good morning. I thought I had a good argument until I heard this guy. I'm starting to reevaluate my Philly fans.
See, now, why can't we do that to conservatives? We do it to Philly fans, but not conservatives. We flip them.
You forgot about the death threats to Mitch Williams.
All right.
Yeah, Mitch Williams, who blew the World Series, they made him leave the town.
Right.
He couldn't live in Philly anymore.
Well, listen, I'll tell you what. I know that Rosencrantz's not ever going to go to a home game in Philadelphia. He'll never be there. T.O.'s agent will never go down there. But,
Drew Rosenhaus,
Rosenhaus.
Rosencrantz.
Yeah.
Now, Ed, when I was talking to you before, you said that a good excuse for Philly fans being just, you know, they're rowdy, but they generally are positive, is the fact that they booed Donovan McNabb on draft day.
Right.
Booed him mercilessly. Well, but then they took out a page in the newspaper apologizing for that.
The front page, we're sorry. We did a whole redraft of him, and we cheered him on.
That's so great that the defense of the city is, well, but we apologize.
We said sorry. Listen, Ed, thanks a lot for calling, man.
No problem.
Thanks, you take care. Let's go to, we got somebody else in Philly, Sean, who's listening to us, as was Ed on XM. Sean, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys.
What's up, man?
Oh, man, I was just listening to that last call, and just like him, I heard that guy talking. I'm sitting there like, oh, God, what the hell am I going to say?
wait a minute. You got to know something. Pashman is a Giants fan, all right?
Yeah, I know. You know what, though? New York is so hated down here as far as sports. I mean, we love your city. We go up to a party, whatever. But when it comes to Giants and the Devils and everyone else up there, to heck with them.
But Dan's family was followed home because they wore Giants jerseys to a Philly game.
Yeah, they followed my cousins back to their car in Philly.
Yeah, you know, I got to agree. I mean, it's extremely passionate down for sports, and they definitely get out of control.
Yeah, passionate is one word.
No, I gotta stand up and defend Philly, because I actually like the city of Philadelphia a lot. And I have to say that you know, Philly fans are not without some degree of finesse. Sean, thank you very much for the phone call. When my wife's cousin played in Philly, he played for the Phillies for a period of time. His name is Doug Glanville. And he was also involved in helping to draft some plans for the new stadium down there, right?
Right.
So he's taking batting practice one day. This is a true story. He's taking batting practice one day. And a fan who stands like right at the edge of the stadium says, "Hey, Glanville, I heard you're working on some plans for the new stadium here in Philly." So, you know, Doug turned around and kind of nodded and said, "Yeah." So, well, I hope you plan to build a stadium you can get a hit in. That's Philadelphia fans,
that's
right? Right?
Chris, didn't you have a story about a friend of yours?
Yeah, a guy I used to work with. He does 9 to noon on WFAN here in New York. He and his family went to Philadelphia for a Giant Eagles game. And he's a big-time Giant fan. And he has a Giant bumper sticker on his car and everything.
Right.
So he parks in the parking lot, and he goes into the game, and like he's getting really bad looks from the Eagles fans. So he's like, whatever, you know, don't worry. They're not going to do anything. We're all fans. They understand. We're all just, you know, it's all just a game. He comes out after the game, after the Giants won, and his car was flipped over. Like, 180. It was flipped over on the roof.
Oh, my God.
And I bet there's just a bunch of Eagles fans standing around going, "Shame what happened to your car."
Hey, man, that's really too bad. Let's see if we can get Richard in. Richard's calling us from WINZ in Miami. Hey, Richard, what's up, man?
Hey, no, I just wanted to, the guy stole my thunder a little earlier. I mean, I love the city of Philly. I've been there. It's a great place to go. But, you know, here's a fan base who would vilify Mike Schmidt, telling him he was a horrible hitter. He never tried. He was one of the greatest third basemen of all time. And then when he gets in the Hall of Fame, oh, he was the golden boy of Philly. Still is.
Yeah, I know. He didn't go straight to sainthood like Ditka did in Chicago, that's for sure.
Oh, well. Not as fast.
Yeah, right. Well, listen, you got Ricky Williams down there, so you got something to talk about in Miami, right?
Yeah, but Ricky can't stay away from the weed, man.
Listen, Richard, thanks a lot for calling. Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, it's too bad. But sports radio!
You know what's amazing, though? That I put Philly fans up on the call list there because they were defending it on the phone to me. As soon as they got on the air, they're like, I got no cash. I got nothing. Look at this. See this thing that I'm holding here? It's a big vat of nothing.
Oh.
Yeah, I got one more thing to say. We got better cheesesteaks in New York.
No.
That's true. You know?
Y'all are really
Riley,
hitting a load
if
of dough.
You know it yourself. You've been to the place
I've been
here in
to
New
the
York.
Place here in New York, 99 miles from, to Philly. I'm sorry.
It's the name of the place.
It's the name of the place.
That's about a safe distance, 99 miles.
And then Patrick says, it should be changed to 99 miles from Philly.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Coming up, we're going to talk to former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, who hopefully doesn't have a chip on his shoulder about the city of Philadelphia. And we're going to talk more about the MTA here in New York allowing cell phone calls in the subway system and a directive from the United States government. Watch out for vagrants who are actually terrorists. Stay with us. This is Air America Radio at 16 minutes past the hour.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
21 minutes past the hour.
My goodness, time is flying when we're having fun up in here.
Yes.
This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. And right now, it is time to say a good morning to none other than KJ himself, Mr. Ken Jones.
Good morning, gentlemen. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we have Mark Maron's iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator, slightly used. But let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. From USA Today, Pat Robertson calls for the death of Hugo Chavez. All right, Pat Robertson calls for the death of Hugo Chavez. Translation, U.S. foreign policy to include more smiting. Smiting. From Reuters, ex-Halliburton worker pleads guilty to bribes. Ex-Halliburton worker pleads guilty to bribes. Translation, one Halliburton worker got careless about bribes.
Just takes one.
From the Associated Press, study finds more fast food near schools. Study finds more fast food near schools. Translation, students major in McFailure.
My goodness. Thank you very much, Mr. Jones.
Indeed, no problem.
Nice work. And you know, Ken Jones knows about Drum Corps, man, so his man is near and dear to my heart.
Oh, he's all about it.
Oh, yeah.
The season's over. I'm a little sad.
That's not over yet. We still got the senior season to finish.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, right. Senior season? What was that like?
No, it's not. Don't be a wise guy, Mr. Philly.
Are you in the senior
season? Yeah, why aren't you? Come on, Pops. How come you don't play in the senior season?
I used to march senior 20 years ago.
Wait. So you're too old for the senior season?
Well, juniors, remember, only go to 21. Seniors is anybody over 21.
So do they have like an old timers day then?
Yeah, every contest I go to is an old timers day. What are you kidding me? Enough about Drum Corps, which I duly love, and you guys are going to pay for your negative remarks. But, you know, we now have the United States government warning us to watch out for the homeless because they could be terrorists conducting surveillance. Now, according to someone in our ever watchful government, this is the kind of thing that is just, this is a State Department report that was issued last week. The State Department has no immediate comment, but they do say that homeless people easily blend into urban landscapes, Dan Pashman.
Right, exactly. I'm not easily blend in. I mean, I really found that story pretty offensive, Riley. I'm not sure what if you took it the same way.
I mean, what it says to me is, you know, they're looking for terrorists everywhere, but exactly where terrorists usually are. Now, they're not saying that suicide bombers are masquerading as homeless. What they're saying is that people who are conducting surveillance on bridges and tunnels and that sort of thing could possibly, be doing so as homeless or vagrants, which is a really, really bad term.
Right. Well, and it says they're warning people to be aware of vagrants who seem out of place or unfamiliar.
Yeah.
Doesn't that describe like 90% of all vagrants?
I guess. I mean, I don't even know. You know, at one time you get arrested for vagrancy in a lot of American cities. But this refers to an incident, by the way, that took place up in Somerville, Mass., very close to where we did our live broadcast.
Yes, and very close to my alma mater, Tufts University.
Yeah, this was up in Davis Square, where apparently there was a man walking back and forth in front of a Social Security office in Davis Square, and he kept looking at windows. It was right after the London bombings in July, and apparently he wasn't arrested, but he was very evasive about what he was doing. But they passed, Somerville police passed the information on to the FBI, and I guess they're figuring, based on that particular incident, folks ought to be a little nervous. I don't know.
Yeah, but the reason why I find this offensive, Mark, because to me this is conservatives killing two birds with one stone.
Yeah.
All right, on one hand, they get to make you afraid. It's like, see any vagrant person, any quasi-homeless-looking person on the street anywhere, that could be a terrorist. Be afraid. Then the second thing they're doing at the same time is they're making you hate homeless people more.
Yeah, I mean, it is just another reason to talk bad about the homeless, to make it seem as though they are potentially something worse than they are.
Right.
And they're not bad people, most of them, if people actually spent the time to talk with them. Now, here in New York, They have decided, we talked about this a bit yesterday, they're going to double the number of security cameras in the New York City subway, bus, bridge, and tunnel system across the five boroughs of New York. They're going to have new security cameras. They're spending a really high amount, $212 million over 3 years, and they gave that to a group of contractors led by none other than Lockheed Martin Corporation, which is best known for their jet fighters. Now, hopefully, they'll have a security camera somewhere up near the Hellgate Bridge, where they've apparently had a freight train derail, and it's disrupted service between New York and Boston for the last 48 hours, it seems. But at this point, they're going to be looking for people. They're also going to have motion sensors, which ought to be real interesting in the subway system, where there are 4 million people a day walking through train stations for motion. I don't know what they're, how would the motion sensors ever stop?
Yeah, the whole thing is questionable. I really kind of have mixed feelings about it, Riley. I think we'll have to continue to watch this situation as it progresses and see it has potential for abuse. It has potential to keep us safer, and we'll see how it's used.
Well, yeah, hopefully it'll help people to get their way through traffic. You know, they have these new traffic cameras that are all over the city anyway, providing traffic information to people. So
right.
I don't know, you know, how intrusive it could end up being, but, you know, this is New York, so believe me, there'll be a test case, and there'll be one very soon.
Yeah.
Coming up next, former Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, Robert Reich, joins us. He'll tell us why the supposed economic recovery, what recovery? How come it hasn't trickled down yet to most average Americans? We're not feeling it in the pocketbook, and former Secretary Reich will tell us why next. It's 27 minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. And, you know, it's very, very weird. If you talk to or read any Republican talking points, you find out that according to the GOP, the economy is rosy. Unemployment is down. Job growth is up. But is that the real deal? Is that what is actually going on? Joining us now to give us his take on the economy is former Labor Secretary during President Clinton's first term, a professor of social and economic policy at Brandeis University, and the author of Reason, Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. Let us welcome one of our favorite guests, former Secretary Robert Reich. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Mark. How are you this morning?
I'm doing fine. Thanks a lot for being with us.
I'm delighted.
Let me ask you first and foremost. I mean, you know, the Republicans say that they've got some pretty impressive economic numbers here. In the last year, according to GOP.com, job growth is up in 48 states and the District of Columbia. 34 states experienced job gains in July of this year. Unemployment rates down in 31 states in the District of Columbia in the last year. Total wage income is up about $75 billion this year over projections. Good news all, huh?
Well, there are a lot of data there, Mark. I mean, look, there's something called the business cycle, which means that eventually the economy starts coming back, and if the economy were not coming back by this time, this number of months after the recession, we'd all be scratching our heads and saying, why not? I mean, the good news is obviously good news, but it would happen no matter who was president and no matter what the policies were, basically. What the Republicans are not talking about and what many Americans understand, which is why Bush's approval ratings on the economy are so low, is that wages and benefits are basically dead in the water.
Hmm.
Most Americans are not seeing any growth in wages at all.
None at all.
No, in fact, if you are a non-supervisory worker, that's 80% of the workforce are non-supervisory workers. These are workers who basically are paid on an hourly basis. Their wages actually have dropped during the past year.
Incredible. Secretary Reich, let me ask you, I mean, why does it appear, at least up until now, that American consumers have not been hit hard by this spike in oil prices?
Because housing has been doing so well that Americans continue to turn their houses into additional money, getting home equity loans, for example. The oil price shock will be coming over the next 2 to 6 months, Mark. I hate to say it.
Uh-oh.
I wish I could be upbeat. But look, those oil prices that are now up to about $67 a barrel, very, very high rate, and that is going to not only affect gas pump prices, already is. I mean, I just paid $2.70 at the gas pump for a gallon of gas yesterday. But not only, it's not only gas, but it's going to affect heating oil. You know, you're going to the Northeast and the mid American states up there, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota. If you need heating oil for this winter, you're going to be paying a lot more than you expected. The average family is going to be hit with a total bill, now including fuel costs, heating oil costs, natural gas increases for fuel, of anywhere from $500 to $1,000, over what it was a year ago. And that's a lot for people to have to be hit by.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's going to cut into their spending.
Now, Secretary Rice, we've seen just yesterday, and I know most people have seen this in a strictly political context. We saw Pat Robertson on the 700 Club call for the assassination of Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, the elected president of Venezuela. Now, Venezuela happens to be the United States' fourth largest oil supplier. What would happen to the American economy if Hugo Chavez took Pat Robertson to heart, applied that to the American government, and decided to boycott sending Venezuelan oil to the U.S.?
Well, look, undoubtedly, Mark, Pat Robertson is a kook.
Yes, he is.
Unfortunately, people listen to him, but he's still a kook, and nobody expects that the United States is going to go down and assassinate Chavez. But Venezuela clearly is a big oil field, just like Iraq and Saudi Arabia, and the United States is causing some difficulties. Undoubtedly, Middle East oil, and there's concern about Middle East oil because of what we're doing in Iraq and the instability that that has created. And the same thing goes in Venezuela with regard to United States policy has not been pro-Venezuela, certainly.
No.
It's been very anti-Venezuela. And so you've got trouble spots around the world that may affect the supply of oil. But the big problem for us is not this on the supply side. The big problem is demand keeps growing so fast. Not only China, but our SUVs. I mean, half of the vehicles on the American roads are big, what they're called light trucks, but
yeah.
SUVs, they're gas guzzlers. I mean, unless we have an energy bill, and the last energy bill didn't do it, unless we have an energy bill that really goes after gas guzzlers, that increases dramatically fuel economy standards, I mean, we're not going to get anywhere.
Mr. Rice, why, or explain to us if you can, exactly how rising oil prices affect other parts of the American economy. I was shocked to read the other day that Walmart was adjusting, I believe, its profit picture for, I guess, the latest quarter, based on the fact that not as many consumers were coming to their stores, apparently because of the spike in prices. What other kinds of ancillary effects are there that most Americans don't think about?
Well, beyond the two most obvious ones, which are whether the price of gas at the pump and the price of fuel oil and natural gas when you want to heat your house, oil is used in a huge host of products. I mean, everything that's made from plastic, for example, which is an oil derivative, is going to be more costly. Flying from, anywhere from New York to Fort Lauderdale or any kind of flight is going to be more expensive because, obviously, it already is more expensive because these big jetliners in all of the airlines have to use a huge amount of fuel. But you also find trucks. I mean, everything that we buy in the United States, everything that you buy is brought to where you bought it, likely by a truck or by some transportation form. Mm-hmm. And all of that transportation is going to be more expensive already, is more expensive, which puts pressure, upward pressure, on the cost of everything you buy. So the entire economy is affected by this. It hasn't worked its way through every product and every distribution system yet, Mark, but over the next 2 to 6 months, we are going to see substantial price rises. When I say substantial, I don't mean 10-20%, obviously, but we're going to see them enough that we can actually register them. Consumers are going to be, because consumers already are paying more for fuel, they don't have as much to spend, and they will see that a lot of what they want to buy is going to cost more.
Will this end up actually causing the possibility of an inflationary cycle going on here?
It's possible, although I don't see any signs of inflation. The Federal Reserve Board keeps raising short-term interest rates. I think inflation, even with fuel costs, is a delusion because, prices overall And I'm talking about that the whole price structure is mostly affected by employment, by wages and by benefits. And wages and benefits, as I said initially, are going nowhere. So there's a huge – whatever is happening to energy and food costs is being offset by the fact that most people's paychecks are going nowhere, and so that the overall economy is not showing any signs of inflation.
Mr. Secretary, why haven't American paychecks gotten any fatter?
Because there's been a huge, intense price competition going on. Most American corporations don't want to hire people back. It's been very, very sluggish in terms of hiring. When they do hire people back, they're hiring them at relatively modest salaries compared to what people had before. Most big corporations continue to lay people off, and so most people are worried about holding onto their jobs. They're not going to demand a raise at this point in time. And you've got also, at the same time, a lot of fighting of unions. You know, the union fights continue. Big corporations have, you know, declared open warfare on unions, and the unions movement is, as you know, we've talked about it before, the union movement is a pale reflection of what it used to be, so that they don't have any, very little leverage to push wages up.
Now, you mentioned earlier the fact that part of the reason why a lot of Americans are not reacting to the spike in gas prices at the pump is because they're taking money out of their homes. Is there a danger in what appears to be this home equity revolution that's going on here?
Yeah, there is a danger. There is going to be a kind of pricking of the housing bubble. The housing bubble is not entirely across the United States, but in certain areas in the Northeast, the West Coast, around Chicago, there are places, Florida, there are places where housing prices have got way, way out of line with rentals. Renting prices, and that's usually a pretty good benchmark for a bubble. A bubble is growing. I would say if you had to worry about this U.S. economy, and I think we do have to worry about it, the three things to worry about are the oil prices, the housing bubble, and the huge deficits, the federal budget deficit, the fact Americans aren't saving anymore, trade deficit. Any one of those areas could spell some real problems for us within the next year.
Now, are you saying that people who are thinking about refinancing their homes ought to think twice?
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Housing price, you know, people have too much mortgage debt right now. They're not saving anything. For a lot of people assume that their housing, you know, their house is going to continue to increase in value. They're loaded down with debt. I mean, it's not just mortgage debt, Mark. It's also credit card debt, every other kind of debt. People are too highly leveraged right now. And if housing prices start declining, if they still have their mortgages they're going to have to pay. If interest rates start going up, they've got variable rate mortgages, they're going to have to pay more. If they lose their job, they're going to have to continue to pay their credit card debt. Americans are swamped in debt. It's not a good situation. It's very dangerous.
Are you kind of implying that we could be facing another recession if all this goes wrong?
I don't want to predict another recession. I don't think that there's another. It's not likely that we're going to hit another recession over the next year or two, but the economy could slow considerably. I don't want to be a doomsayer. I mean, this is just a matter of common sense. I mean, oil prices continue to go up. There's no reason to suppose that they're going to go down. The housing bubble continues to grow. That's going to, you know, eventually it's going to explode. It's going to burst. You can't go on being the world's biggest debtor and relying upon China and other nations to continue to finance our debt. Those three problems continue to grow. And you have to have your head in the sand to think that this economy is healthy.
All right. Robert Reich, we thank you so much for being with us. As always, you've given us some great information this
morning. Thanks, Mark.
You take care. Bye-bye. That is former Labor Secretary under President Bill Clinton, Robert Reich. And he, of course, is now teaching at Brandeis University. And he's the author of Reason, Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. Stay with us. I think we got a little war on brains coming up. We're going to talk a little more about Lance Armstrong. And coming up soon, we're going to be getting the latest from Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas, as Morning Sedition rolls on. It's 46 minutes past the hour, and this is Air America Radio.
Attention, mis hermanos and mis hermanas. This is Pendejo.
Viva la Revolucion!
You're listening to Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
51 minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. And coming up, we're going to get the latest from Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. But you know, every week we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the four-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milfington.
Dateline, Hartford, Connecticut, state capital and home of Mark Twain, who wrote Roughing It, an expose on Governor John Rowland's first year in prison. The Bush War on Brains continues, suckers. You'd think after bravely risking life and limb by helicoptering over a dangerous display of wooden crosses to the relative safety of Osmond family inbreeding and kinky polygamy, our shock and ah crap president would finally get enough peace and quiet to nap before his next nap. But no, George W. Bush will have to wait another fortnight for the sleep of the just. Because this week, Connecticut, our president's third hardest state to spell after potato, filed suit against the United States government of America. The charge? Lewd acts in a park restroom. Oh, sorry, that's my George Michael commentary. The charge, No Child Left Behind, is illegal because it's an unfunded mandate. Unfunded in that Bush won't pay for it, and mandate in that it's an order that Bush gave. Hence the term lewd acts in a park restroom. Although persuasive, this argument can never compete with the most compelling one to date against No Child Left Behind, that it might make every other state as dumb as Texas. Yes, imposing a woefully inept educational system upon our independent states. Cutting funding for public schools to produce morons who only know how to take tests. And then forcing me to make a dated reference about George Michael. Are the ingredients of the Bush No Child Left Behind Act his Xanadu? Shame. Diabolical. Connecticut's move makes it the very first state to challenge No Child Left Behind, or NCLF. Let's just call it STD. No? Okay, how about SIDS? No again? Very well. Connecticut's move makes it the very first state to challenge IBS. Huh? Ironically, Connecticut's legal argument against IBS is based on a law first put forth by Republicans during the Clinton administration. Unfortunately, due to poor educational system, most of people don't know what ironically means. I tend to believe it has something to do with hair tonic.
Ooh.
Hair tonic, Mark.
Yeah.
You're familiar with that, and pomade, no
hey,
doubt.
Hey.
Moving on.
Let's not get racial.
So far, school districts in three other states and the nation's largest teachers union have also filed suit. So it turns out the only people left who think they can really benefit from a poorly educated public are either in the Bush administration or right for Rob Schneider. That's all right by me. I just can't get enough of watching my hero on TV saying stupid things to women or trying to have sex with a goat. Ooh. I also enjoy watching Rob Schneider. And that's today's dispatch from
The War on Brains.
Nice work, Mort.
Thank you, Mark Riley. Oh,
yes.
Thanks, Mort.
Thank you, Dan Fashman. Sitting
I know
in
that you're
for Mark.
Yeah, Mark Maron. I know your boy isn't here to offer you his usual support and slamming commentary after one of your wonderful jobs here.
Slamming commentary.
Oh, I guess you're not here for that part, right? You leave the room before he starts up on you.
I love Mark Riley, Mark Maron.
You love Mark Maron.
I love both Marks.
No, you don't. You hate
Mark. No, it's really.
Admit it.
No.
You hate the brothers.
What I hate is this Dan Pashman thing. This Pashman thing has got to stop.
Are you the one that's been emailing?
Emailing?
Yeah. No, emailing about Pashman.
The scented letters.
The scented letters. Is that... Wait a minute. Never mind. We're not going to get into that right now because we have other important stories to deal with. My brother.
Really?
Yeah, man.
Dan Pashman, 55 miles an hour.
Can you sing the AutoZone thing as you leave?
Sure. Get into the zone, AutoZone!
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, Mort Milfington. That's enough of that. Anyway.
That's the shortest applause break ever.
Hey, what can I tell you? We're out of time. You know, this military, I don't know what is going on with these military people who've been convicted and pled guilty with regard to these Afghan detainees that died in their custody. Now a military intelligence interrogator was sentenced yesterday to 2 months in prison. 2 whole months after he admitted abusing an Afghan detainee who later died. He was Specialist Glendale C. Wallace. He pleaded guilty. He will suffer a reduction in rank and pay, and he will receive a bad conduct discharge. Now, the most serious charges were against Private First Class Willie Brand, who's not going to end up doing any time.
It's really, really horrible, Mark. This really offends me. I think this Afghan that they killed, this guy Dilawar, was 22 years old. He was a cab driver. He was slowly beaten to death.
Yes.
Over a period of 4 days, to the point that the medical examiner said that his body was, and I'm quoting here, falling apart. The guy could not stand. They tried to get him. He could not bend his knees because his legs were completely shattered. He had been chained by the wrists to the top of his cell for most of those 4 days when he was slowly tortured to death. And the real clincher, Mark, is that this guy, Dilawar, was an innocent man. And the army... The Army's own investigators
knew
that he was innocent. The interrogators knew this guy was innocent. He simply drove his taxi past the American base at the wrong time. But because these soldiers over there got these orders from on high that said, we want information no matter what, and get that information at any cost, this is the kind of result we get. And the people who killed this guy, murdered him, are getting off scot-free.
Getting off literally scot-free. It's an amazing and should be a very troubling story. We've got some interesting things coming up next, including a conversation with Karen Meredith, live from Crawford, Texas, and a conversation with Michael Wolf from Vanity Fair. This is Air America Radio, 57 past the hour.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six minutes past the hour. Good morning. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. And, of course, we got another hour to be here with you. Mark Maron is on vacation. He'll be back the day after Labor Day. My God. Dan Pashman.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. How are you, man?
All right, man. I'm doing okay. We're getting some late word right now that there is some fighting going on in Baghdad. Apparently, some insurgents and, I guess, coalition forces, U.S. and Iraqis, are standing it off. There's been at least one car bomb detonated. No reports of injuries or deaths yet, but apparently they're targeting checkpoints in and around Baghdad. Mm. So the war there continues to go on, even as our president hangs out for the next little while and has for the last little while.
Right.
It is incredible. Now, of course, he is on his way back to Crawford later today. And on her way back to Crawford today is none other than Cindy Sheehan. And she has, of course, been out in L.A. tending to her ill mother. But now we are seeing a situation where she will be going back to Crawford, pressing her demand that President Bush meet with her. Now, Bush met with some families of fallen soldiers in Iraq just yesterday.
Yeah, he's going to get another 2 hours for it today on the schedule, but no time for Cindy Sheehan.
No time for Cindy Sheehan. Why? Is he only interested in talking to people who wholeheartedly agree with him? The answer to that question may well be yes, because he's facing a huge and growing political problem, one that he, A, did not anticipate. No one could have anticipated Cindy Sheehan.
Right.
And I think he also really has not, much as has been the case in Iraq, hasn't formulated a response to it yet. To say what he said yesterday, which was kind of to almost dismiss her as not being reflective of the will of the American people, is just pap, and I think everybody knows that. Even some of his supporters know that he should be able to do better than that. And it's not like it's short notice. He's known that Cindy Sheehan has been there for some time.
Right.
And momentarily, we're going to be talking to Karen Meredith, who is on the scene at Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. She lost a son in Iraq as well, I believe in Najaf. And we're going to talk to Karen Meredith about exactly what's going on there and how people at Camp Casey are reacting to some of this nonsense out of the mouth of our president. And again, as we talk about this, there is more fighting going on. in Iraq.
It's true, Mark, and I will be curious to hear Karen Meredith's response to some of these things. I mean, Bush is really getting desperate for him to take on Cindy Sheehan so directly. Usually, he leaves this kind of dirty work to his surrogates.
Yeah.
But he was doing it himself. First of all, he said, quote, "I think those who advocate immediate withdrawal from not only Iraq but the Middle East are avoiding, or rather advocating a policy that would weaken the United States." All right, first of all, neither Cindy Sheehan nor anybody that I've heard anywhere has advocated a U.S. withdrawal from the Middle East.
No.
So he's just pulling that out of nowhere.
Well, Osama bin Laden has.
Yeah, right.
You know, okay. Bin Laden has said get out of the Middle East.
Right, okay, you're right. I stand corrected. He's the one. But clearly Cindy Sheehan hasn't said anything like that, nor of her supporters.
Yeah. Right now, we are going to go to our telephone lines. Yesterday, George Bush charged that Cindy Sheehan and the anti-war protesters in Crawford are advocating policies that would weaken the United States. Our next guest is a Gold Star mother who lost her son, Kenneth Ballard, in Iraq last year. She's on the phone with us from Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. Good morning again, Karen Meredith. How you doing?
I am doing okay. How are you?
Good, good. Thank you so much for joining us again. I'm sure you in Crawford got the word from Bush yesterday in terms of his specific diss of Cindy Sheehan. What was the reaction down there?
Well, everybody's pretty disgusted with it. You know, I mean, for him to say that Cindy saying some, you know, saying the things, and for people questioning the war, weakens this country. I think this country was based on questioning our country. So this is more typical of everything that the administration does. We were very pleased to see Joe Wilson's press release that came out, you know, supporting Cindy.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Karen, when we talked to you yesterday, we really didn't get a chance for you to talk to our listeners about who your son was, because I think it's important for people to know that these are not just statistics, these are human beings.
Right. My son, Ken Ballard, was 26 years old. He was my only child, and Ken always wanted to be a soldier, so he joined right out of high school, and then when he was in for 3 years, he decided he'd rather be an officer, so went and got a scholarship, and finished up and was commissioned a second lieutenant, and 1 year later was sent over to Iraq. He was a great guy. He loved music as long as it was loud, any kind. So he was just, you know, I raised him on my own since he was 10 months old. So we were a team, and so it's been kind of hard.
I can imagine. Yes. Dan Pashman wanted to ask you a question.
Hi, Karen. Yesterday in his comments, President Bush tried to portray the stance taken by you and by Cindy Sheehan and by many others down there in Crawford as the minority opinion in the country. He said, quote, "She," meaning Cindy, "doesn't represent the view of a lot of the families I have met with." Now, we already know that 61% of Americans disapprove of the president's handling of Iraq, but as a person in a family who's lost a soldier in Iraq, what can you tell us about the families that Bush meets with? How many families has he actually met with? Does he actually really have any idea what most of the families really think about this war?
He said he doesn't read the paper, so I'm sure he doesn't know what his numbers are.
Right.
That's the smart answer, you know. He has met with 13% of families with soldiers.
Only 13%.
Only 13% from Iraq and Afghanistan. So even if I'm generous and I give him 50%, you know, 6% of the people that he's met with agree with him. That's not a real good number, in my opinion.
Mm. Now, what is morale like out at Camp Casey?
Camp Casey is doing great. We had a wonderful candlelight vigil last night around the crosses. Our favorite Marine, Jeff, played the bugle, played taps, and he was standing with him with Joan Baez. As soon as he finished playing taps, Joan Baez started singing Amazing Grace.
Oh, wow.
You can imagine how amazing that was. We were standing around holding candles and, you know, roses, which people put down by crosses. I was standing in front of my son's cross. It was pretty overwhelming for me because Taps is the hardest song for any Gold Star family to hear.
I'm sure.
Yeah, and so this hauntingly beautiful, the sky was clear and a million stars, but we had luminaries between among the crosses, the, you know, candles. And it was, with Joan Baez singing Amazing Grace, it was, you know, like an angel, like she sounds like. So
yeah.
It was a pretty beautiful moment last night during then, but she continued her talk about her her peace activism, and she's just such a wonderful person. But everybody is, and we had several hundred last night. So that's kind of the news.
Yeah, it sounds like it's good news. Tell us a bit about, you know, Joan Baez talked about her own very storied history of activism. What else did she say to you last night?
Well, that was what it was. She was just continuing what had happened, and, you know, from the night before. She talked about being in I think it was Brazil, where she couldn't sing certain songs, and you know, how a lot of that was because they didn't want her to talk about peace. She would sing songs that she wasn't supposed to. Anyways, just all of little vignettes. But I think it was more of an encouragement to say that we were doing the right thing by questioning. And she's been doing it for 40 years. And, you know, if I can do it for 4 years and look as good as she does, then
I'm absolutely.
Karen, we received word early this morning. There was a post on Huffington Post blog posted by Cindy Sheehan entitled Coming Back to Crawford. She says she's coming back. She doesn't say when in the post, but she says she's coming back. What can you tell us? What have you heard on this front? When can we expect Cindy to return?
Well, I've been looking for the press release, and yes, but I'll tell you a secret, but don't tell anyone.
All right.
Okay.
She'll be coming in to Waco this afternoon.
Oh, fabulous.
All right, great.
Fantastic.
I think we're going to go out and meet her, and I'm sure all of the press will be there because the White House press corps will be getting back today, too.
Yeah, and I guess Bush is coming back today. I guess you'll be able to see his helicopter fly over you, will you?
Oh, no, I'm sure he's flying into Waco, too. Maybe that's where he can meet Cindy.
Maybe they'll end up in line waiting for their bags.
Bags, yeah, really.
right.
Karen Meredith, thank you so much for being with us this morning on Morning's Edition. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
You take care.
And we'd like to direct people to a Gold Star Families for Peace website, which is gsfp.org, and also a phenomenal website that is a tribute to Karen Meredith's son, Kenneth Ballard, who was killed in Iraq last year. That's ltkenballard.com, Lieutenant Ken Ballard, but it's just ltkenballard, one word, .com. A great tribute to her son, Ken.
Absolutely. Coming up next, I think Mark Maron is definitely on vacation, but I think we're going to hear from him anyway, aren't we, Dan?
I think we're going to take a visit into the future.
Right? Yeah.
Future Mark.
Future Mark coming up. And, of course, later this morning as well, we're going to be talking to Vanity Fair contributing editor Michael Wolff about Plane Gate, Rove Gate, however you want to describe it. It is a gate. And why the media bears some responsibility for the fact that this story is kind of like disappearing into the ether. Stay with us. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. It's 17.
Morning's Edition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. Kinda, because every week Mark Maron gets a call from his future self. And since he knew he was going on vacation this week, he didn't want to miss out on his weekly advice from 50 years in the future. So before Mark left, he recorded this conversation with Future Mark. Let's hear that, Chris.
Hey, buddy, what's up? So Future Mark, what's going on in 2050, man?
I'm in therapy.
Oh, wow. Oh, so is this a bad time to call then?
No, why? It's just us. You're me anyway.
Oh, that's true. So what's that noise? I thought you were in therapy.
Well, you know, therapy's come a long way since then. You can either go the traditional couch and talking thing, or, of course, there's the chocolate cure. Turns out those lonely heavy ladies were right. It does make you feel better.
Oh
and then there's Dinosaur Island.
Whoa, wait. There's a Dinosaur Island therapy option?
Dude, you get to fly around in a helicopter gunship and blow the crap out of clone dinosaurs.
That works? As therapy?
You have got to see a T-Rex splattered across a hillside. It totally resets your gauges, man.
All right. Well, so what kind of therapy are you doing?
Well, you know, I thought about working through all my issues and stuff, but, you know, I've been down that road, so I just said, you know what the hell with it? I'm just getting a new brain with it.
Wow. So they're just, like, new brains sitting around?
No, it's mine. They grew it from my stem cells down at the Brain King.
Brain King?
Yeah. Don't go to Brain World. They put in a lot of extras and then charge you later. Oh, hold on a second. They're backing my new brain in right now. There might be a couple seconds here while I'm brainless. Bear with me.
Okay.
So anyway, you can have the neurotechies take stuff out of your brain, like memories, or you can put new ones in, you know, just whatever. You just say, oh, hold on, wait just a second, they're securing it. Oh, it's got that new brain smell.
Oh.
You're all set, Mr. Barron.
Wow, I feel terrific. I feel smart, good-looking, like I can do anything.
Wow, what's that like?
Excuse me, Mr. Barron, can we just give that new brain a spin real quick?
Yeah, sure, whatever you want.
How do you feel about your mother?
She was perfect, man. I mean, she let me eat whatever I wanted. I was like the luckiest kid in the world.
Sounds like it's working fine. Enjoy your new brain.
Wow, man. Just wow. So, any advice for me?
Yeah, you know that expression, digging to China?
Yeah.
Don't make a big thing of it. Just start digging there.
Okay.
Hey, buddy, really great talking to you, okay? You rock, man. Does anyone tell you that today? Well, you do. You rock. I'll talk to you later, man.
Later.
Wow. Even when he's not here, he has interesting conversations with himself 50 years from now. My goodness, I can't imagine what I'd be like 50 years from now. Can you imagine, Dan? See, you'll still be, well, you'll be in your 70s 50 years from now. So.
Yeah. Well, we experienced Future Mark Riley in a previous episode of Future Mark, remember?
Oh, that's right. That's right.
You were starting the clone revolution.
That's right. Power to the clones. I don't know about power to the profilers, but there's a controversy brewing at the Justice Department. Because the Bush administration is replacing the director of a small branch of the department months after he complained that senior political officials at the department were trying to play down newly compiled data on racial profiling. And this is certainly aggressive police treatment of black and Latino drivers. The official's name is Lawrence Greenfeld. President Bush named him in 2001 to lead the Bureau of Justice Statistics. And see, now, that's a very small agency. It has about 50 employees. You know, Justice Department is a gigantic agency. So in this instance, it's a small component of that agency. But they put together some stats about police stops and threats of force. And what they found was that once they were stopped, Latino drivers were searched or had their vehicles searched by police 11.4% of the time. That sounds awful low. Blacks, 10.2% of the time. Whites, 3.5% of the time.
There you go.
Less than half as often. Way less than half as often.
Yeah.
Blacks and Latinos were also subjected to force or the threat of force more often than whites, and the police were very much more likely to issue tickets to Hispanics rather than simply giving them a warning. Now, this is not news to anyone who lives in the tri-state New York metropolitan area.
Really, almost anywhere in the country.
Yeah. But, I mean, this guy tried to put those numbers out in a press release.
Right.
And his political supervisor at this bureau said, oh, no. As a matter of fact, the woman who vetted this particular report actually crossed out some of these numbers by hand. Certainly the references to higher rates of searches and uses of force against blacks and Latinos, crossed it out by hand with a notation that said, do we need this?
Oh, man.
As a black person myself, I have to ask this woman, whose name is Tracy A. Henke, do we really need you?
Yeah, right.
I mean, come on. Let's be real about this. Blacks and Latinos who have been on America's roadways know how law enforcement operates. And these numbers bear that out. I still think 11% and 10% is way too low, but, you know, I could be quibbling here. The bottom line is someone that tried to bring some truth to light here got demoted for his trouble.
Yes.
Coming up next, Michael Wolff, contributing editor at Vanity Fair, talks about Plane Gate, Rove Gate, and so much more. It's 27 minutes past the hour. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. And we've got a very special guest in studio. He's a muckraker. He likes to start trouble. He charges that the media is complicit in the Karl Rove Valerie Plame CIA leak cover-up in an article in the September issue of Vanity Fair. He is a contributing editor with that prestigious magazine, and he joins us live in studio this morning. Good morning, once again, Michael Wolff. How you doing?
I'm good. How about you?
Excellent, man. Thanks for getting up so early.
Not at all.
Now, you know, when media people talk bad about media, they usually get slammed by media, and not always the media that they talk bad about. But why do you think that the media's got some responsibility in this whole Rovegate Plame CIA thing?
Because they didn't tell the story. I mean, it's amazing, preposterous, if you think about it. They had the story. They knew that a strong possibility that a crime had occurred as close to the president as you could possibly get had taken place. They knew this. They had these facts. And they sat on it. They swallowed it. They decided it was better for us, the media, not to tell this story. So damn our readers and our responsibilities, we won't tell it.
Why? Why did they make this decision? I mean, I know that people in positions of power in media make some strange decisions every now and then, but why? Why hide this?
Well, I think the real reason is because they have their heads up their asses. I mean, in a very real way. I don't think that anybody quite thought this out. I don't think somebody said, oh, we got one of the big stories of this administration. Let's obviously we have to go with it. Instead, they thought, oh, you know, this was told to us by a source, and we're journalists, so we have to protect our source. And if we don't protect our source, we won't get any more stories. So that's what we have to do, instead of thinking, no, hello, the very fact that this was your source becomes the story doesn't occur to them, because you know, and end of the day, like anybody in any profession, they don't think too much about what they're doing and about themselves and exactly about what things mean.
To what extent did the media punt on this due to the fact that one of the early people in this whole thing was a media person, was Robert Novak?
Yeah, I think that they punted entirely. I mean, they punted because it was about them, and no industry likes to be put in a position to essentially deal with itself. But also because for that's what I was just saying is that ultimately it's they're talking about their business contacts. It's their business. Oh, Rove, you know, we're kind of in business with Rove, so we got to protect them.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because it turns out that Rove had talked to a number of different journalists during the course of this, on this and other subjects. But, you know, nothing makes media people, and especially journalists, more holier than thou than the whole notion of protecting sources. What's wrong with that in this case?
Well, I mean, I don't think that there's, in general, there's nothing wrong with it. In general, there's everything right with it. But in this case, the source became the story. That is the story. Now let's create priorities here. And on the top list of priorities, if you're a journalist, it's to tell the goddamn story. You don't have any other function but that. That's your job. That's why you get paid. That's the reason you exist. Anything else comes below that. And they got it bollocksed up.
Right. Now, I know that you have taken your beliefs to public forums with some of the players involved here, some of the decision makers in this entire affair, and kind of had a couple of interesting verbal confrontations, no?
A little fisticuffs, yes.
What happened? Tell us.
No. I mean, nothing. There was a panel last week, and Norm Perlstein, who's the editor-in-chief of Time, Inc., who was involved with this, was on the panel. Floyd Abrams, who's the First Amendment lawyer. Actually, at some point, Floyd Abrams, that became Floyd Abrams' name. Floyd Abrams, First Amendment lawyer. It's amended on his birth certificate. And then Richard Cohn, who writes for the column for the Washington Post and is in the bosom of the Washington Press Corps, and then me, and it got lively. I mean, actually, Norm was who I thought and who I kind of went after in my piece was not only gentlemanly about the whole thing, but I think has done some hard thinking about this and rather comes out, I think, closer to my point of view than to the traditional journalist point of view. But Richard Cohn was absolutely adamant, refused to see any black and white here. You know, when a reporter gives his word, whatever that means, he must keep it. And that was also the Floyd Abrams point of view, absolutely without nuance. So they become actually like lawyers. We're right. Everybody else is wrong.
But now, Michael, doesn't giving your word and then backing off, isn't that an act of betrayal? I mean, just in the real world, never mind in the world of news or media or whatever, if you tell somebody, I am not going to do something, then you turn around and do it, haven't you betrayed that person?
Yes, so. I mean, life is filled with betrayals. I suppose it is an act of betrayal, but you know, there are greater and lesser acts of betrayal. I mean, I would say, you know, your first loyalty is to your readers, and what you promise them is if you have a story, you print it, and not printing it is the ultimate act for a journalist of betrayal.
But now, if you tell someone, I'm not going to reveal your name, and then you know, that person says, oh, well, okay, I'm going to tell you this, and this. At what point do you make the decision?
Well, there's a couple of things going. There's a couple. Here's the real world context. This goes on all the time. Everybody says, this is on deep background. I've never given. They always say it.
Yeah, they do.
And most of the time, you just ignore it. And actually, the source ignores it too, because they forget. They don't know, because it's not really on deep background. Because what is deep background? And in this case, you know, Matt Cooper at Time started to call it double secret, super deep, or deep background.
Animal House.
I mean, we're into a level of hyperbole, and also then the real world also is that that lots of people know who your source is, and let's remember, as this broke, you know, it was widely regarded that the source here was Karl Rove. How do people know that? Well, people know because Karl Rove is blathering all the time to other reporters, so they know. And people know because reporters themselves talk. You know, I mean, we suddenly set this up that, like, reporters are like priests. You tell me something, and I'm a priest. Reporters are blabbermouths.
That's why we all end up in green rooms, because Michael and I have been in green rooms together before. We get in green rooms, we'll open our wrists metaphorically.
Right. They just talk to everybody. So that suddenly that this has become this moment of pure orthodoxy. I will never reveal the identity of my source. Is made up. It's a myth.
Now, is Cooper a hero and Plame a villain as far as you're concerned? Cooper decided to, I mean, his boss decided to release the information. Judith Miller is right in the can because she hasn't talked. Is she the villain? Is he the hero?
No. I mean, Matt Cooper, who I'm very fond of personally, I don't think is a hero. I mean, I think he got caught in he's the opposite of a hero. It's a very deeply ambiguous situation that he's in. Perhaps for the right, for what he thought were the right reasons or for good intentions, I mean, he made a decision, as a decision that I think is the wrong one. I think he had a story to tell, which he subsequently told, by the way, mm-hmm. making it even stranger. Oh, I can write it now, because I'm not exactly why he could write it now, but he did write it now, and it is exactly the story that he should have written almost 2 years ago. And if he had, Karl Rove would have been out of a job, and not impossibly that would have changed the course of the election.
You know, I get a sense from your piece that this entire affair is metaphor for something bigger. And I've always felt in the years that I've done this job that the question of access was going to be a really big problem for a lot of people in terms of just checking certain journalistic principles at the door simply to remain on someone's good side, to be able to continue to talk to people, to get your phone calls returned. How much of a role is that playing in modern journalism, and is it too much of a role?
Well, I think the part of the background here is the enormous success, the overwhelming success, the really unique success that this administration has had in getting its message through the media in a largely unfiltered way. They have handled the media better than any administration beforehand. Now, and I must say that's the way we always look at this, and we always say, you know, this administration has handled the media better than the ones that have come before,
yeah.
Which is natural if you think about it, because everybody learns more and more lessons. But what we're seeing, and we arrive at somewhat of a critical mass, is that the media, for all sorts of structural reasons, can be used, can be manipulated. That's a skill set that that people at the other side of the media have learned brilliantly, and no one more so than Karl Rove in the Bush administration, or the Bush administration through Karl Rove. So this kind of brings us to the ultimate point. This example. And finally, bottom line, all of these reporters and journalists got used.
Michael Wolff, the name of the piece, All Roads Lead to Rove. Is the Vanity Fair out to September already?
Sure.
All
yeah,
right, so it's available on Newsstand. Yes. I commend it to your attention.
Jennifer Aniston on the cover.
Michael Wolff. Jennifer Aniston on the cover, but look inside. Michael, as always, great to have you here with
Thanks
us.
Thanks a lot.
We appreciate it. We are going to wrap and tie this thing, land this plane, next here on Air America Radio. It's 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Morning Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Is it possible for you to shut the f*** up for 10 seconds?
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Where my Kangol at? 51 minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. And we wanted to update you on that story coming out of Baghdad. Insurgents attacked Iraqi police patrols in western Baghdad with 3 car bombs and small arms fire. 3 people killed, 10 people wounded. 3 policemen were wounded, 3 civilians were killed. And the carnage goes on in Iraq. When will it end? I think Cindy Sheehan may hold the key for us. But right now, Kent Jones is here with us in studio. Good morning, Mr. Oh, I'm sorry.
Morning, everybody.
Was that a wrenching segue?
Transition, everybody.
All right, we'll take it from the transmission. Go ahead.
Here we go. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Clip Notes. Obesity rates have risen in every state except Oregon. Some medical experts are saying that obesity runs in the family. Well, run may be too strong a word. It kind of walks for a while, gets out of breath, sits down, then gets up and tries to walk again in the family.
Oh.
During a speech in front of a large group of obese people in Louisiana, policy analyst Radley Balko proposed substituting government control on obesity for a free market system. Unfortunately, seconds after he said the words free market,
He was trampled by the stampeding crowd. U.S. officials say Americans should be on the lookout for terrorists posing as vagrants. After careful study, the terrorists decided that if there's one thing that inspires trust and attracts people into a subway car, it's a vagrant. Authorities say to report anyone smelling of urine carrying the sign will work for jihad. The New York Jets are mulling over the prospect of moving to a Queen Stadium in Flushing Meadows. Talks with the city over a possible stadium are just beginning. This being the Jets, they'll undoubtedly wait until the last 2 minutes to blow it. Jets officials say if we don't like the look of the World's Fair site, we'll pass. And hopefully that will work out better than it did during last season. Of course, a stadium in Flushing could lead to jokes about the Jets being in the toilet.
Ooh.
But it's better than an alternative site in the town of Perennial Loser, New Jersey. Today's phrase, just drop this into conversation. So, Pat Robertson wants to kill Hugo Chavez. Wake up, sheeple. The Ten Commandments are only the 10 friendly suggestions to that hypocrite.
Nice job there, Ken Jones. Nice job all morning, man. We appreciate it. Right. Now, Brendan B. Mac McDonald has been dealing with the rash of emails. Reacting to Dan Pashman's bashing of the city of Philadelphia, his sliming of how many people? 1.5 million, I think.
Not that many.
Well,
I
felt bad, Mark Riley, because we got some callers on the air from Philly, and we thought they were going to defend their fair city. And as soon as they got on the air, they said, yeah, what that guy said is kind of true.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess in the anonymity of email, people do feel a little more emboldened. And these aren't actually very vicious emails. They're just trying to bring up some points here. So I figured I would read them and defend our friends in Philadelphia who listen to the show. This one came from a guy named Alan who's currently living in London.
Uh-oh.
Who says, I grew up in Philadelphia and find Pashman's remarks both slanderous and sadistic. He clearly does not understand the situation. We grew up in an atmosphere of losing big games year after year. The boos are not directed at one person. They are a collective expression of accumulated frustration. In essence, we are like abused children who at many times manifest certain antisocial tendencies. It's not totally our fault. This is from Alan. And, you know, I happen to troll the internet to find out if there was any proof to this. And I think there is. Here was a headline I saw on January 23rd, 2005, Eagles win NFC title, fans boo hot dog vendor. As the clock wound down to the Eagles' first NFC championship in four consecutive attempts, confused Philadelphia fans began booing an incompetent food vendor who dropped a hot dog. Quote, I felt sorry for the poor guy, said one resident who witnessed the verbal assault. Philadelphia fans are just so accustomed to booing at the end of an NFC title game that when the Eagles won, they had to vent on somebody.
Whoa, Santa Claus, hot dog vendors, who is next? Pashman, don't ever, ever set foot in Philadelphia, man. That's all I can tell you.
Is that a threat or a promise?
No, man, I'm just telling you, man. People know.
I think
right?
we have
you
to
suck,
clarify.
Get out.
We have to clarify, though. Kent Jones was there, too, so maybe he can help. When we were in Philadelphia and we had Philly cheesesteaks from Pat's, which is the world
Mecca.
Famous.
Yeah, the best.
They were wanting. You know, there was a staleness to the bread, and you definitely don't find that down here on 3rd Avenue and 12th Street at the Philly cheesesteak restaurant.
The Philly
cheesesteak.
Yeah, it was like dog food. It was really
whoa,
disgusting.
Calling a Philly style steak dog food?
Look, in response to what that emailer said, look, there are a lot of fans in a lot of different cities that feel like their teams are perennial losers. There's only one city where they have a jail in the basement of the stadium.
All right, well, in the brief time we have left, this one's more directed at Kalo, because this guy said, as I sit here and listen to Pashman talk about civilized New York fans, what about the New York Mets in September of 86 who came to the Vet to watch the Mets clinch the pennant and after their team was swept had to be arrested for stripping seats out of the stadium? Let's make certain to bring that up now. But Kalo, you got to tell people about who that Mets team was and the kind of karma that it brought out with fans.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, come on, that's a team that they tore apart an airplane. I mean, the fans are just a mirror of what
that...
Dude,
yeah.
You have no idea.
That team was like the WHO of baseball.
Yeah.
Yes, they were the rock stars of their time. Like, you, you can't imagine what kind of team that was. Doing cocaine off of strippers and hookers. I mean,
that's baseball.
Yeah.
That's a team.
Buy
I grew
me
up
some
on.
Peanuts and cracker jacks.
And coke.
Let's go. No, you guys are rough, man.
Snort one for me, babe.
Hey, I love Philadelphia. Listen, coming up tomorrow, Betsy Rosenberg from Air America's Echo Talk will talk about what environmental issues are being swept under the rug. We'll have another update from Crawford, Texas, and the latest installment of Morning Sedition Radio Theater. All y'all, thank you very much for being here with us. All right. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.